I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator. We're glad you came out on this slushy evening. I'm sure you will find it worth the effort. As we begin, let me remind you, please, to silence cell phones or any device that might disrupt the event. We appreciate it. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce John Snyder. John has been a patron of the library for years now, and we're honored to think we've helped a little bit with his two books, Hill of Beans, Coming of Age in the Last Days of the Old South, and Crossing Ethiopia. Some of you may have heard him read from Hill of Beans at one of our Live from the Library evenings, and if so, you know you're in for a treat tonight. Before writing his books, John retired as an executive director of Morgan Stanley. He holds 7 patents, won first place in the New York Film Festival for an industrial film, and wrote 2 off-Broadway plays. Such a well-rounded person is best suited to provide a portrait of complex times in Africa, and I'm pleased to note that Crossing Ethiopia has received a very positive response from the Ethiopian community in the United States. Please join me in welcoming John Snyder.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. Can everybody hear me clearly? You can't. Sarah, you want to give me a hand here? Okay. How is that? That better? Okay. The slightly mad venture described in Crossing Ethiopia came about when I read Alan Moorhead's The Blue Nile back in the 1960s. It was published in 1962. And I was intrigued by Tewodros, the man, and by Ethiopia, the country. This is Tewodros from the official account of the expedition that the English War Department published. In a nutshell, Tewodros was a self-made king who rose by sheer genius, military and otherwise, from obscure bandit leader to the emperor of Ethiopia. And he immediately perceived what England had and Ethiopia lacked. And he wrote Victoria seeking closer relations. And insulted by her failure to respond, or the parliament, whoever received the letter, he imprisoned the British consul and ultimately most of the other Europeans in Ethiopia, thereby drawing in a huge army of almost 64,000 to spring 67 white Europeans. And he had all of the men lying in chains atop Magdala, which was the royal prison and treasury, a truly remote place in the middle of Ethiopia, 400 miles from the Red Sea, and itself 9,100 feet above sea level. All of this takes place in the mysterious fabled highlands of Ethiopia, source of the Blue Nile, and it's an incredibly mountainous place from 7,000 to 15,000 feet above sea level, and it was never conquered by outsiders. The drama approached its conclusion as Britain's large invading army and King Tewodros' much smaller force converged on Magdala, his prison, in 1868. This map shows the respective lines of march of the two armies. The British landed up here on Annesley Bay and marched due south 400 miles to Magdala. It took them 4 months to get there. They started with the 64,000 men and eventually an army of 5,000 crossed the Bashilo River for the Battle of Magdala. Meanwhile, King Tewodros, this was his capital, Deborah Tabor, and he marched with his army on this route to Magdala and got there 2 weeks before the British Army did, and it was this expedition that I made from Deborah Tabor. I followed his line of march, which is across country that was basically roadless in 1972. Just to give you an idea of the kind of terrain that these two armies had to cross, this is a contemporary etching showing the British at Dongolo on their march south. This is about 200 miles along their way, along the 400 miles. And this is the kind of terrain that they crossed for the entire trip. It's an incredibly rugged place. And meanwhile, Tewodros is approaching from his capital, Deborah Tabor, and he had had his lay missionaries make this enormous 7-ton mortar for him, and he had run out of horses and mules by that time, and he dragged it to Magdala with 500 men. And this is, he dragged it down into the Jeddah Ravine and then up on the other side, and it was a trip that took him 41 days to make this crossing of the Jeddah. The British crossed it on the road that he had made in one long day. It was 18 miles across it. In any case, I decided back in the late 1970s, in the early 70s, that this would make a great movie and that I was the one to make it. So what qualified me to write such an ambitious film? Well, basically nothing. I was 38 years old, and I was working for a small carpet mill where I wrote brochures and ads, but I did do the company's still photography. And my only movie experience came about one day when my boss called me in and said, "John, our distributors don't believe we really have a mill. He said, I want you to go down south and make a mill film so we can prove it to them." So he gave me a budget of $10,000, and I made a 20-minute, 16-millimeter film called Revolution Underfoot, of course, for the carpet business. And it won first place in the industrial category of a New York Film Festival. And following that triumph, I enrolled in Flora Schreiber's film writing course at the New School, hoping that might be a way to get me out of the carpet business. I don't know if you know who Flora, if anybody remembers Flora. She wrote a best-selling book called Sybil about a woman who had about 25 different personalities and was made into 3 movies, and I think she did quite well with it. But she taught film writing at the New School, and she had a little contest for her students. The person who wrote the best script got to produce it in the New School auditorium. And back in 1967, I won it, and Flora brought in a real film critic who, after viewing, one of my plays was called The Transcontinental Redemption of Buster C. Dunn, which is about a man who had cornered the kerosene market. After watching this masterpiece, he allowed that I had a pretty good ear for dialogue, and he said, "Since you aren't married, why don't you move out to Hollywood and give it a shot?" So, well, I soon got married to Joanne Kennedy, who is here tonight, a girl who wanted to live a normal life and raise a family, so I stayed on at the carpet company and didn't go to Hollywood. But my determination to go to Ethiopia remained strong, and I went about, set about making plans to go. Good if this paper would come apart. Well, the problem was, how in the world would I get to that part of Ethiopia, and how would you follow King Tewodros's march from Deber Tabor to Magdala? And I started by calling the consulate here in New York and Ethiopian Airlines. Petros Solomon, the acting consul, who is also here tonight, he asked me to write him a letter explaining my motives for the trip, which I did. And then I went to Solomon Mangesha. Everybody's got Solomon at one end of their name, manager of Ethiopian Airlines, and he said this seemed so complicated I should drop by the office and talk it over. And when I got there, he said it's simple to get to Lalibela, Axum, Gonder, and Addis, but as for Magdala, nobody ever goes there, and he couldn't be of any help. So he tempered this disappointing news by inviting Joanne and me to a cocktail party. And there, who did I run into but Petros Solomon, to whom I had just sent the letter explaining my motives, and other New York members of the Ethiopian community who befriended us because of my interest in Tewodros, who is a great hero in Ethiopia. From those days, I'm sorry. From those days, this is a photograph, and that's Petros Solomon on the left at one of the many parties that he and Solomon invited us to. But I, having been told that nobody ever goes where you want to go, I still had the problem of trying to find a way to make this expedition. Fortunately, I had read a book on Tewodros by Sven Rubinson, a historian who taught at Haile Selassie I University in Addis, and he was retiring to Sweden, but he said that he had a colleague, Dr. Donald Crummy, a fellow historian who was also an expert on Tewodros, and he referred me to Dr. Crummy. And Dr. Crummy turned out to indeed be interested in going on the march with us, and said that he had a student in Deborah Tabor, Shumit Shashin, who is here tonight also, who could join us, and Deborah Tabor is our translator. So Dr. Crummy himself would obtain permissions to transit the provinces we had to cross. We had to go about 454 kilometers from Gondar to Magdala. So the problem of getting there where nobody goes was solved, and we set it up to meet Dr. Crummy in Gondar, the ancient capital, on December 31st, 1971. Not knowing exactly what we were getting into, we packed tents, sleeping bags, freeze-dried food, and my big Mamiya Flex C-33, trusty 2.25 by 2.25 camera with bellows, and headed out. Well, on the flight from Athens to Asmara, which is in Eritrea today, Eritrea was part of Ethiopia in 1971, and that was our first stop. We happened to be sitting next to a retired police chief from Milan, and we told him where we were going, and he said you'll need at least 2 armed guards, and he illustrated the consequences with a cutthroat and rolling eyeball routine. And anyway, we landed there in the middle of the night, and this gave us something to think about. But Asmara in the daytime turned out to be a beautiful little city, 7,600 feet above sea level, with delightfully cool air. It was quite unthreatening, and I began taking pictures. And here, this is partly a picture show, so here's some pictures of, this is Asmara in the background behind these two brothers. These are 4 boys who reluctantly posed for me. And here's a man who did likewise. Go back now to the this is a close-up of the northern part where the British landed. I wanted to go down from Asmara to Massawa on the Red Sea coast. You see Massawa on the upper right, and Asmara was not on the map at this time. It's just to the east of Massawa on the top of the highlands. I wanted to see where the British had landed with their 44 elephants, and they actually built a 20-mile railroad to the foot of the escarpment to move their supplies to the mountains themselves. It's an incredibly hot desert down there. Now, you could get down to Massawa by descending 7,600 on the highway that begins right here in the lower right-hand corner. That's considered one of the most twisting roads on Earth. Or you could go on a short hop. Ethiopian Airlines at the time had a huge fleet of DC-3s, so we took the DC-3 alternative, and this is Joanne about to board. And this is the runway at Massawa, the gravel runway, and we emerged from the plane into a furnace-like desert atmosphere, and were faced by a squad of soldiers with automatic rifles who were extremely tense and searched us thoroughly because at that time the guerrillas of the Eritrean Liberation Front were very active and about to move further on up toward Asmara. So it was a little scary. After a night in the Red Sea Hotel, we returned to the airstrip, and the soldiers seemed even more agitated than the day before. One of them insisted on opening about a half a dozen rolls of my 120 film with his bayonet because he apparently thought they were little sticks of dynamite. Anyway, they finally let us on board the DC-3, and as we lifted off and climbed back up to the crest of the massive escarpment, this for centuries shielded Ethiopia from the outside world. And it reminded me of how in 1843, 2 young Englishmen returning by ship from India looked up at this same prodigious mountain wall and on the spur of the moment decided to go ashore and plunge into the heart of Ethiopia. They were Walter Plowden, then 23 years old, and John Bell, both of whom would play a vital role in focusing Emperor Tewodros' attention on the West. Plowden was deeply impressed by Tewodros' ability and potential, and he eventually became the first British consul in Ethiopia. John Bell, a military officer, joined the emperor's army. He went native. He started wearing Ethiopian garb, and he never went back. He became a close and trusted lieutenant. And it was Bell who introduced Tewodros to Shakespeare, which he called Bell's Bible. I think this gives you an idea of the dimensions of Theodore as a person. He was a remarkable man who appreciated Shakespeare. Well, tragically, both of these men died in 1860 when Tewodros' plans to reform his feudal country were still possible. Plowden was murdered in the countryside, and Bell was killed fighting beside Tewodros against the rebels who had killed Plowden. And they are both cited in Tewodros' famous letter to Victoria, which went unanswered and from which I'll read a portion here. Everything Tewodros wrote was in very elegant language, and this one begins, "In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, King of Kings, Theodorus of Ethiopia, to Her Majesty Victoria, Queen of England. My fathers, the emperors, having forgotten our Creator, He handed over their kingdom to the Gallows and the Turks. But God created me and lifted me out of the dust and restored this empire to my rule. Mr. Plowden and my late Grand Chamberlain, the Englishman Bell, used to tell me there's a great Christian queen who loves all Christians. I gave them my love, thinking I had found your Majesty's goodwill. All men are subject to death, and my enemies, thinking to injure me, kill these, my friends. But by the power of God, I have exterminated these enemies, not leaving one alive, 1,500 of them. Although they were of my own family, that I may, by the power of God, get your friendship. I wish to have an answer to this letter by Consul Cameron, and that he may go with my embassy to England." Well, this is the letter. These are excerpts from the letter that went unanswered. In addition to showing how much Plowden and Bell meant to him, his letter also reflects his deep Christian faith. Tewodros had been educated in a convent school, and he knew the Bible by heart. He could actually out-argue all of the Orthodox priests on religious intricacies. And I think the story of Tewodros might have well ended quite differently than it did had these two men and his beloved first wife, Tawabetch, lived. All three were lost to him early in his reign, and without their settling influence, he was beset with constant rebellions, and all of his reforms were frustrated, and it brought out a darker side of his nature, and he gradually became a changed man. Now, to switch from that, as Joanne and I went into Ethiopia, we stopped by Axum and Lalibela, and these are really just tourist spots, but they're quite outstanding, so I thought you might like to see a couple of shots of them. This is what the Axum Airport looked like in 1972. It was a gravel strip. And this is what Axum is really famous for, the stelae, which are all carved from single pieces of stone, and most of them date to the 4th century, and some of them are actually pre-Christian. From Axum, we flew by DC-3 to Lalibela to see the 13th century rock-hewn churches, and I'll show you a few shots of them. This is St. George's, which is carved out of living rock, and it's not only carved out of the ground, but it's also fully finished and carved out on the inside, as are all of the churches in Lalibela. These are clergymen inside of Libanos Church. And outside on a hillock, these boys all pose for me. So you can see what a beautiful countryside it is in the background. This boy is wearing what's called a mateb around his neck, and that signifies that he's a Christian. From Lalibela, we flew by DC-3 to Gondar, the ancient capital, to await the arrival of Dr. Crummy the next day. And as we had a drink in the courtyard of our hotel, A tall, deeply tanned American with a huge knapsack introduced himself. He said he was a tightrope walker from the circus, and he explored exotic places like Ethiopia in the off-season. And on hearing our plans, he said, one doesn't hike in the Ethiopian countryside. The shifters, that's the Ethiopian word for bandits, will kill you for your boots. Two of my buddies tried it and were lucky to walk out in their underwear. Well, with this warning and having also heard from the police chief from Milan, we didn't sleep too well our first night in Gondar. But in the morning, Dr. Crummy arrived. Here he is. From Addis. He flew in from Addis with his wide-brimmed hat, which he never took off, and he had a little black suitcase strapped to his back. And when we recounted the tightrope walker's warning, he brandished his dullah, which is this ubiquitous Ethiopian walking stick, and said, nonsense. We have official permissions from Crown Prince Asfawasin, Haile Selassie's son. We will not be harmed. You think I would take such a risk having a wife and small children? Well, that reassured us. And that night, under a full moon, we passed a church on our way home from dinner, and pointing to the graveyard, Dr. Crummy told us that this was the final resting place of Walter Plowden, the murdered British consul. I mention him again here because it was Plowden's replacement, Charles Cameron, who Tuodras commissioned to deliver that letter to Queen Victoria in 1862. And rather than deliver it personally, Cameron had it forwarded to London from northern Egypt. And then he made the mistake of returning to the Emperor's camp without a reply. Well, this qualified him to become Tuodras' first hostage. He was thrown in chains until a reply was received. The next day, we explored Gondar while Dr. Crummy made the final preparations for our trip. Now, Gondar's famous for its Portuguese-influenced castles. This one was built by the 17th-century Ethiopian king Phasaelates in the Portuguese style. And lions were traditionally housed in a part of this castle, and they still had them for rent there when we went through in 1972. So here's Joanne posing with a small lion of Judah for a small fee. And in the afternoon, We took a taxi 60 miles south to Lake Tana, from which the Blue Nile, it's the source of the Blue Nile, it flows out of it. And on returning to Gondar, we learned that Dr. Crummy had called Deborah Tabor's single telephone and to check in with Schumet, our translator, and he was told that Schumet's father had died and he wouldn't be able to accompany us on the trip. So we had a little conference and Dr. Crummy decided we'd go on anyway, despite his less than fluent Amharic. The next morning, we took a bus south to Wereta, and from there, a Land Rover would take us east to Deborah Tabor, to Otis's capital, from which he had departed for Magdala on his last march. And Dr. Crummy told us to enjoy the pavement, because it would be the last we would see for hundreds of kilometers. Here again is a map showing where we are and where we're going. We had just come down from Gondar on the upper left to a point opposite on the eastern bank of Lake Tana, opposite Deborah Tabor. And we were going to take a Land Rover over to Deborah Tabor to pick up Schumet if his father hadn't died. And then you'll see a place called Gafat up at the top. And this was what I would call Tuodras' Silicon Valley. And I'll explain that as we go along. Anyway, we arrived in Wereta, and it was market day. This is a giant waka, a wild fig tree, which is in the center of the market. And these people are selling blocks of salt that are brought up from the Danakil Desert on the Red Sea. They were, for centuries, they were a form of currency. And while taking these pictures, I was suddenly whacked in the back of the head with a clod of dirt. I found that my big Mamiya Flex, I had a red filter on it to take to make the clouds pop out, and apparently that was taken as a source of the evil eye, and we beat a hasty retreat from the market. And after recovering from my punishment for propagating this evil eye, we boarded a Land Rover with about a dozen other fellow travelers for the dash to Deborah Tabor. And it was a dash because there were rumors of bandits in the area, and the formula for avoiding them was to go as fast as you could and never stopping. And as a last resort, the driver had a .45 caliber Colt strapped around his neck. Anyway, we made it. After a bone-jarring 3.5-hour ride, we came to Deborah Tabor, and to our amazement, we were greeted by Schumet, whose father had not died as reported, thank God. Here's Schumet. And we pitched our tents in the yard of Schumet and his fellow teachers here, and here are Don and Joanne and Schumet the next morning. Schumet was doing his year of national service in Deborah Tabor before continuing to get his degree at Haile Selassie I University in Addis. Now, since we're in Deborah Tabor, you probably would expect to see his castle, but there is none. Tewodros always lived in the royal tent, and in his heyday, it would be surrounded by the tents of his army, which would consist of 40 to 50,000 men. And if his army hadn't been reduced in size to around 5,000 at the time of the British invasion, this battle would probably have come out, the whole story would have come out quite differently. From Deborah Tabor, we hiked north for 2 hours to Gafat to see the remains of the houses and workshops that Tewodros built for the 6 lay missionaries and their families who worked for him there harmoniously for many years. He used them to build roads and in the end to build armaments for him. And these workers were contemptuously referred to by the other missionaries in the country as the Gafat people or the Gafat workers. They looked down on them, but Tewodros took very good care of them. He built them homes, and he treated them quite well in return for their technical ability. That's why I call it the Silicon Valley of Tewodros. It's as close as he could get. He tried. Now, I should hesitate a moment here to describe the European Protestant missionary situation in Ethiopia during Tewodros' day. They came in 3 flavors. First, they were the conventional missionaries who were out to convert anyone they could. And second, there was a group from the London Society for Promoting Christianity amongst the Jews. And they were zeroed in on the Falasha of black Jews. And finally, there were the lay missionaries who taught trades and proselytized by example. Well, Tewodros particularly disliked the first and second categories, and he forced them to baptize anybody they converted into the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, while he befriended the lay missionaries whose technical skills he highly valued and whose preaching he ignored. I mention these missionaries here because each group contributed to his inventory of hostages. 6 from the categories 1 and 2 were imprisoned early on, and although the Gafat people, the lay missionaries, remained free until near the end, they and their families added up to 22 of the 67 hostages. And interestingly, 25 of these hostages turned out to be children, and 11 were women. And 2 of the women were daughters of John Bell, who had married who married 2 of the lay missionaries. I think it's also a good time to read one of Tewodros' most perceptive quotes, which bears on the colonial role of missionaries. And to quote, "I know the tactics of European governments when they wish to acquire possession of Oriental states. They first send missionaries, then consuls to support the missionaries, and then armies to support the consuls. I am not a Raja of Hindustan to be humbugged in that fashion. I prefer at once having to do with the armies." And he was to follow his own advice. Now, I'll go back to the narrative of our trip. And here I'm going to follow with a series of photographs taken between Deborah Tabor and Gafat of people in places that were truly little changed since the time of Tewodros. And what I thought was particularly remarkable in 1972 was the pristine quality of the countryside. It was as yet unreached totally by Western packaging. There was no plastic, no paper, no cardboard, and other modern trash. Whatever was discarded returned quickly to nature. So it made for a very beautiful countryside. This is a photograph of a horseman that we encountered between Gafat and Deborah Tabor, which I used for the cover of the book. This is a clergyman and his shama at a nearby church, a rice stubble after harvesting. This is why I used a red filter on the camera. It makes these huge cumulus clouds pop beautifully. I'll keep this map up for a little bit because we're leaving now from Deborah Tabor and we're starting east ultimately to Magdala. We had originally planned to travel from Deborah Tabor to our next stop, Nefes Mucha, by Mulin, but Schumann had suggested that we obtain rifles to guard against shifters. But Dr. Crummy insisted that we rely on our permissions, saying the bandits would kill us for the rifles. In any case, we didn't go on foot. The pistol pack and Land Rover driver agreed to take us in his Land Rover, and we made it to our destination in a day. But it was a day of passing through incredibly beautiful rolling country, and we did have a couple of breakdowns. We had two flat tires and one axle that gave us a problem, but they were all fixed. That's our first breakdown. These are tukuls, the traditional Ethiopian house, silhouetted against the sky. And we passed just north of Mount Guna, which is one of Ethiopia's highest mountains. It's 14,210 feet above sea level, and it was actually covered with a sprinkling of snow as we passed under it. These are two handsome Ethiopian horses in a stubble field, and with a red filter, you get cloud shadows pop out as well as the clouds, and it made a nice moonscape of a picture. And this picture, I think, is probably the best one I took on the whole trip. It's just what I consider a truly biblical landscape, a man plowing a wooden plow and another crossing the countryside. In any case, we arrived at Nefes Mucha, our next stop, which was the home of the governor of Gayent province, at about sundown in a mixture of sleet and rain. And as soon as we had pitched our tents, we were invited to have dinner with the governor. And he turned out to be an incredible host. And our two nights in Nefes Mucha were the highlight of the trip. And here's some pictures of the governor and his family and associates. This is him with his sister, and that bulge under his sweater is his German Luger, which he had carried, and he had fought Mussolini's army during the Italian occupation of 35 to 41. This is the governor with his secular staff, and this is with the religious arm. This is the way Ethiopia was traditionally divided up at that time. The governor would have, he'd have the people who ran the province, and they respected the church, and they were sort of equally powerful. These are his priests. And this is a picture of Schumann at 22 holding an automatic rifle. And this is before Schumann spent 3 years as a guerrilla fighting against the dictator Mengistu, and that experience moderated his fascination with guns. He tells me he never wants to see another one. These girls are the twins, and they were the daughters of the governor. Beautiful. faces. And this is one of his associates, when that's a classic Amharic profile with his shama gathered up around his neck. I'll bring the map again now. Nephis Mucha doesn't show on this map, but it's about halfway between Deborah Tabor and this Jitta River here, which in Ethiopian is called Jitta, Z-H-I-T-T-A. We had, after the two nights in Nephis Mucha, the governor helped us prepare for the next 90 kilometers of our trip, which would be, this time it would really be by mule and foot, and it would take us to the brink of the Jitta Ravine at the place called Bitor, which you can, it's called Bator on here, but that was our goal in 2 days. The governor helped us engage the muleteers and gave us passes to cross the provinces that were under his control. And this next series of photographs were taken as we're on this stage of the trip. This is Shumit and the muleteers getting ready to get underway. That's me crossing the Wadla Plateau in the footsteps of Tewodris. We followed his exact course. In the course of the day, we came across dozens of these threshing floors where the grain is separated from the chaff in the ancient manner of throwing it up and letting the wind blow away the chaff. And they looked like small tornadoes across the countryside. It was quite a beautiful, beautiful sight. I don't know if it still exists, but this was our first night on this part of the expedition. We always camped on threshing floors. Here we are breaking camp at dawn for the next leg. The next night, we camped in the police compound of Bitor itself, a few miles from the brink of the Jitta Ravine. Dr. Crummie was suffering from dysentery, and Joanne was dreading the day ahead because we had to cross the Jitta and get on to Wargeltena. Our next stop, that was to be 40 kilometers, and we had to get there in order to rendezvous with a biologist who had a Land Rover who would meet us and take us on the last leg to Magdala. So we had to do it. We had to make it. And this is as Joanne begins her descent into the Jitta Ravine, the 3,500 feet down, crying all the way and saying, "If I get out of this alive, never again." This is her halfway down, and this is the ravine itself. Now, that's how it looks in the dry season. During the summer rains, this whole thing would be a roaring torrent and wouldn't be crossable. And that's one reason that emperors like Tewodris had trouble with rebellions, because when the provinces that were separated by rivers were separated by these floods, there were no bridges, so you couldn't get in to suppress them. And when he finally did, he did it with some rather cruel methodology. This is just to remind you that Tewodris dragged this thing, this huge 7-ton mortar, down into this ravine and up the other side, and that's what took him 41 days. And the British came behind and covered it in one, following it. But they were carrying their heavy guns with elephants. They actually went all the way into Magdala with 44 elephants and came out with 42, which is amazing. As we came out of the Jitta, this is a beautiful village. It was just sitting on sort of a shelf of the eastern bank of it. And finally, we emerged onto the Delanta Plateau in late afternoon, and we still had to walk north to Wargeltena, which we arrived there at 10:30 at night, half dead, and we had made our 40 kilometers. So we pitched our tents and woke up in the morning to this scene, to see where we had camped. And as we cooked breakfast, a group of men descended from these boulders up at the top with a body lashed to a stretcher. And the man had been hanged while we slept. And Shumit asked why, and they said he killed. So he had been executed while we slept. Another little sobering note. But anyway, we had made our rendezvous with Michael Bray. He was a biologist who had slept in his Land Rover, and he was doing research on sandflies that carry leishmaniasis, which is a terrible parasitic disease. And he worked for the Wellcome Parasitology Unit in Ethiopia as a one-man operation studying these flies, and he had charts all over his walls of where he had found them. He went out on a horse every day. But anyway, in his Land Rover, we crossed the Bashilla Ravine, which is another 3,500 feet down and up again, which we would have had to done on foot or on mules had we not made the rendezvous with him. He was going to wait for us that morning, and if we weren't there, he was going back. In late afternoon, we arrived on the Tanta Plateau that overlooks Magdala from the north, and the priest of Tanta Michael Church arranged for us to camp in the police compound and served us a great dinner of Wadden and Jera. And from Tanta that night at sunset, we at last saw Magdala laid out before us. So that's the 9,100-foot mesa of the Royal Prison. Now, we were coming in from the north. The British came around from the south and came up from the opposite end. And the next morning, the priest provided horses to take us up to the top of Magdala. And this is where all those prisoners live, some of them for up to 4 years. It's about a mile long and a half a mile wide with precipitous cliffs coming off on two sides and barely accessible at either end by gates. Now, we're on Magdala, and I'm just going to describe how things quickly concluded back in 1868. Tewodros arrived there with his army of about 3,000, now 2 weeks ahead of the British. And he watched them through his telescope as they descended to cross the Bashilla River. And at that time, he was drinking heavily and was quite agitated, and nobody knew what he was going to do. He was quite dangerous, and especially the hostages. On this map, you can see the relative positions of the where the prisoners were and where the two armies were. This is Magdala up here, and this is where the prisoners were. And then you go through a gate onto this plateau here, Salamji. That's where Tewodros' army was. And that gate, there's about an 800-foot elevation there. And then this drops off 1,400 feet down to this place called the Oroji Plateau. Now, the British had crossed the Bashilla down here and come up through here to the Oroji, and that was the setup for the battle. On Thursday night, April the 9th, 1868, in a drunken rage, Tewodros hurled some 200 of his own native prisoners over these cliffs. That's my picture from the north, and this is a contemporary etching from the official. This is from, actually, Stanley was on the expedition. He was 26 at the time, and he wrote a book called Kumasi and Magdala, and this is from his book. Anyway, the Europeans on top heard these screams of Tewodros' dying prisoners and were certain that he was going to throw them over next, but for reasons known only to him, he didn't. He spared them, and he fell to praying to God for forgiveness. On the next afternoon, it was Good Friday, April the 10th, 1868, he saw the British troops emerge on the Oroji Plateau, where that you see them lined up here below. His troops are up on the upper right on the top on a place called Fala, which you can see in the inset, and 1,400 feet above them, and he ordered his army to attack. And they fell upon the British by flowing down these slopes on their ponies, but they were armed with spears and muzzle loaders, and they were mowed down by the British mountain guns, rockets, and it was the first use in military history of the Snyder not mine, spelled differently, breech-loading rifle with horrific results. The British could, a British soldier could get off 8 shots a minute with a breech-loading rifle and with a muzzle loader. You know, you got one and that was it. And his men didn't expect to run into that. They had been instructed to rush in and fight hand to hand while the British were reloading. Well, the British never had to reload. So the results were horrific. To Odrus's army, there were 700 killed and 1,500 severely wounded, and the British, 2 killed and 18 wounded. So to Odrus realized that with his army virtually wiped out, he decided to send down negotiators to talk to General Napier. And he made a deal. He thought he had made a deal where if he turned loose the hostages, they would actually help him in his own country and that he would not be forced to surrender. His own officers advised him to kill them all, which he didn't do. He sent them all down unharmed. So with the hostages safely in hand, Napier demanded to Odrus's surrender, and he refused. So the British, they marched up from Oroji towards Magdala itself. This is from a contemporary etching there, on their way to that plateau just below Magdala to set up. And on Monday, April the 12th, they attacked Magdala with full force with their rockets and their mountain guns. It's amazing that in 1868 they actually had rockets and guns of incredible power, which nobody in Africa had ever seen. Anyway, Tewodros defended himself at the gate to Magdala itself when all was lost. He shot himself with a pistol that had been a gift from Victoria back in 1864, and it had this it had this engraving on the back of it. This was engraved on the butt of the pistol. Presented by Victoria, Queen of Great Britain and Ireland, to Theodorus, Emperor of Abyssinia, as a slight token of her gratitude for his kindness to her servant Plowden, 1864. This is my photograph of the place where at the gate to Magdala where Tewodros ended his life. Before leaving to march back, 4 months on the road again with all of the freed hostages, the British burst all of Tewodros's cannon and burned Magdala. And as for that mortar, Sevastopol, which was dragged to Magdala with such effort by Tewodros, it was never fired. Morehead thought it had been fired because it had been loaded with too much powder, but it had burst. But it's obviously not burst, and I don't think they could maneuver it into position in time to use it in the battle. So for all that work, it still lies there. And there was a fellow who was guarding it, and we walked up to him, and he said, "The Americans made it for Tewodros," which we probably would have in this day and time. But anyway. This is me leaning on a stone which is thought to be the original gravestone of Tewodros. And here we are with our adventure over. We gathered at the house of Michael Bray, the biologist, to say goodbye. And that's Michael on the left, Joanne with the dog in her lap, me with a pipe, Schumet next to me, and Dr. Crummy with a cup of coffee. One final shot, which I call mission accomplished. This is the road sign 435 miles from Gondar, where we had started out. Now, I'd like to conclude by reading an assessment of Tewodros from Clement Markhams, who, in addition to being a well-known historian for his Arctic work, wrote a wonderful history of the expedition. And this is what he said of Tewodros. "He was a genius and a very remarkable one. It's a misuse of terms to call him a savage, except in the sense that Peter the Great was a savage. They were both born kings of men, both endowed with military genius, both lovers of the mechanical arts, both possessed of dauntless courage, and while capable of noble and generous acts, both were frequently guilty of perpetrating the most horrible atrocities. And that concludes King Tewodros. If anyone has any detailed historical questions, I'm going to ask Schumet to answer them. Schumet is now sitting here in the front row, is professor of history at Christopher Newport University in Newport News. He came to the States. He and Dr. Crummy both returned. Dr. Crummy became head of the African Affairs Department, right, at Urbana-Champaign, and Schumet came over and got his Ph.D. under Dr. Crummy. And unfortunately, although Dr. Crummy vetted my manuscript, he died last August. And otherwise, we would love to have had him here. But anyway, I'll take any questions. I can try to answer them. The Ethiopia is one of the most wonderful climates on earth. You know, you're 7 to 10,000 feet, and it's just moderate and cool, and it's an incredibly beautiful and moderate place. So it was great. It was cold at night. We often had sleet. When you had thunderstorms, you would have sleet, and sometimes the ground would look like it had snowed just from the accumulation of ice. But then when the sun came out, it was warm. So it was a wonderful place to travel in, and still is. Yes?
In such a dry area, what did you do for drinking water?
We used halazone pills, and they made you quite sick. They made me quite sick. And we took enteroviruform against malaria, which we took a number of shots, but we didn't really have any health problems. And we avoided all those bandits that were billed so highly and didn't work out. Yes.
Did you ever return?
I did. Nor did I write the movie script, which this book is written in expiation of that sin. You had a question back here, miss?
Jeannie.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
I was going to ask about all the bandits you were warned about, but
they didn't materialize. They stayed in the wings. Alpha Wasson was Haile Selassie's son, and Don Crummy had actually gotten permissions from him. And then the way you crossed the countryside in those days is each governor would write on a slip of paper a permission, just a piece of tablet paper, and you showed it. Otherwise, they wouldn't let you pass. So that's how you crossed the country. Now, Schumet, am I right?
Yes.
Yes.
I was going to ask about not so much the purity of the drinking water, but on the top of that Magdala, where you're looking, you're way up high.
Yeah.
Where's the water coming from? Were there springs up there?
There were springs. They always had a water supply. They had no problem with water. And these English, the captives, lived quite a good life up there. The Englishmen had gardens. They were in contact with the coast. They were able to get money, and they had three-course meals. The only problem they had is they didn't know whether they would live or die when Tewodros arrived. But while they were waiting, they lived it up. They made puddings. They raised tomatoes and vegetables. They fed the birds. They did what Englishmen do. And by rights, they could have all been wiped out. But I think one of the most interesting aspects of this is how many of these prisoners were men and were women and children, and how few were Englishmen. They were, by my count, there were only five Englishmen, and the Parliament voted the equivalent of $5 billion to spring them. And they took the other guys out with them, but it's an incredible hostage situation. The fact that it's 400 miles, 4 months to get there, And if Tewodros had had his original army, they would have been intercepted in that wild country and they would never have gotten there. But as it was, they were chiefs who were rebelling against him, and the British made good use of them, and they were allowed free passage the whole way, which facilitated the expedition. There are two huge volumes this big, by the War Department, the official history of the expedition, in which they list every donkey and every mule and every saddle, and they had the Indian army, and they actually had to feed several different types of Indians. You know, they had different Indians who ate different menus, and the English planned it all, and everybody got what he was used to. Yes, sir?
I'm not so sure I want to take on those three volumes, but there are
Well, not my expedition, but the British. Yes, just read. It's the last section of Alan Moorhead's The Blue Nile, called The British in Ethiopia, and it's about 40 pages. And he does a great job of it. Where I differ with him is he was very severe critic of Tewodros and said he was a megalomaniac and emphasized the cruel things he did, which he did do. But he had enormous hope to begin with, and to come up from, as he said, raised from the dust, and the place where he came from. I think he was a remark. It's a true tragedy.
What was the name of the book again?
The Blue Nile by Alan. He also wrote The White Nile, which is another marvelous. At the time of this expedition, they had just discovered the source of the Nile. You know, it was, and Moorhead did a great job of describing all of the adventurers who found. Yes.
What happened after Tewodros died? Was there a power vacuum?
There was a power vacuum, and one of the men who had aided the British became the king. Schumann, help me on that.
Johannes
Fort, so one of the Dinah Rotis
that had been fighting with Tewodros eventually ended up in defeating the other opposition and becoming emperor.
Yeah, he was
a
first. Yes, Jane.
In the Metropolitan Museum last summer, there was an exhibition of Julian Margaret Cameron photographs, and one of the photographs was of Tewodros' son,
yes,
who went to England. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah, his son was just a boy when his father was killed, and the British took him back to England, and Victoria took a special interest in him, and they made a little Englishman out of him. You see photographs of him in tweed suits and things, but he died at the age of 19. A lot of people think of a broken heart. He was ripped out of Ethiopia and put in a world that, you know, had no meaning to him, and it's a very sad story. Am I right, Schumann? Is it? Yes. Yes.
John, thank you for a fascinating narrative. Can you tell us a little bit about the countryside today?
I can't, but I'll ask Schumann to tell you.
It's probably much more crowded now than it was in 1972. The land had degraded significantly. I've seen part of it 2 years ago, and it's really a very different landscape that you see.
Yeah. What you have to remember is Ethiopia, after we left, 3 years after we left, Haile Selassie was deposed and he was murdered by Mengistu Mariam, the dictator who was responsible for killing people in prodigious ways that Tewodros couldn't imagine. Probably over 1 million people were killed, including a lot of the students, and that's why Schumann became a guerrilla against Mengistu. All the students originally were basically Marxist, and they thought that Haile Selassie was, you know, he was outmoded and he wasn't giving people a chance, and they wanted a revolution. But when they got the revolution, this major Mengistu turned out to be a horrible man, and he soon went after the students. So, and the other thing that happened was there were two severe famines in, what, 72 and 70 and 85, which killed you. Everybody remembers seeing that in the news. There were thousands of people died, and then you had this dictatorship take over, and he was Mengistu now lives in Rhodesia. Courtesy of Mr. Mugabe, who took him in with all the money he stole from Ethiopia. And this Mengistu was deposed in 1991, am I right, Sherman?
91, yes.
Yeah, in 1991. And I'm not an expert on the political history since then. It's very complicated. Yes. He was General Napier, and he became Lord Napier, and his statue is in London. You've probably seen it. He became a great man. He was head of the Indian Army, and they selected him. It's amazing that when Cameron was put in chains for not, you know, because Victoria hadn't answered this letter, the British made an attempt to, they finally sent an answer in, but they sent it in by an Iraqi, an English citizen, an Iraqi named Rassam, who spoke Arabic. Tewodros also spoke Arabic, and they sent him in to try to, you know, give a reply. But by then, Tewodros's empire was declining on its own, and he decided to make Rassam and his group, they became the English. They were basically Cameron first, and then the group who came to rescue him were the only Englishmen who were hostages. So for those five or six guys, this enormous army went in. And it's really amazing, because I would say the odds were that Tewodros would have killed the hostages, and they would have done it all for nothing, but he let them go. Yes, Mark?
John, did the English expedition take anything else back with them besides...
They did. The atop Magdala was the royal treasury. And Tewodros had brought all of the stuff accumulated from all the kings, enormous amounts of gold and crosses, and the British took it all. A lot of it's in the British Museum. And they also had an auction right afterwards, and they divided up the proceeds. The people from the museum were on the expedition, and they paid so much for each one of these things, and then they whacked up whatever the proceeds were among the soldiers. And then they marched out. It's a strange situation. But, yes?
Given this horrendous history with Great Britain, why did Haile Selassie seek refuge in London during the war?
In London?
He lived in Putney.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to answer that, except I don't think this reverberated that much with him. He spoke English. He also spoke French. You know, when he made that famous speech to the League of Nations, he did it in Amharic, but they said that he could have done it equally fluently in English or French, but he didn't. It's one of the great speeches of all time. He said, if you hear, you're standing aside while Italy, a country, takes our country, and he said, why won't you do something about it? You may be next, in essence. And they didn't. They voted basically to do nothing.
He lived in England because England sent the Enterprise, the boat, to pick him up in Djibouti.
Yeah.
And to take him through Gibraltar up to London.
Yeah.
And
it's
put him in Bath, where he bought a house.
This lady has written a book about this herself, so she knows more about it. I don't know that much about Haile Selassie, except I think he's viewed more favorably now than he was when he was overthrown, because I think changing a society like Ethiopia from a feudal society the way it was to a modern society, it involves a lot of uprooting. Schumann can attest to that. You come from the countryside, and suddenly you can't go back. You can't go back where you came from. Schumann's story is, I think, quite moving. His father saw students and said, I want to send one of my children to school. And he said, I'll send my firstborn, and that's the only one he could afford to. So Schumann's brothers and sisters would always remain peasants, and yet Schumann now has a PhD and, you know, and is a scholar, but he can't go back and plow anymore. You can't go backwards in a society. And it made for a lot of problems. A lot of the students got to Addis, and there was no work for them. So they were educated, and they couldn't go back. But they couldn't do anything civilized either. They couldn't be farmers or bureaucrats. There was nothing. But now I'm not the person to talk about this. But I think that's just pretty true. Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much.
It's so beautiful in the photographs. Your lecture, your passion, your respect for the culture is unbelievable. So I thank you very much.
Thank you. I think they want to thank you all.